Palisade Radio is preparing to release an in-depth report on the fundamentals of uranium, including our top three picks for 2019. Sign up today at palisaderadio.com to be the first to receive our exclusive report.
Welcome back to another episode of Palisade Radio. This is your host, Colin Cattell. We've been working on our 10-part series on uranium, which just finished up last week, but no special on uranium would be complete without a new guest to the program that we have on today, John Borshoff. John is the MD and CEO of Deep Yellow. But if you've been around in the industry for a while, you've heard of the great story of Paladin that Rick Rule oftentimes discusses, a company that had 10,000% gains for some investors who came in. And Paladin was one of the best-known companies of the last uranium cycle. John, thanks for taking the time to come on the program with us today.
It's a pleasure, Colin.
Well, John, let's start with your story and your background. Paladin was founded in the last cycle, actually prior to the last cycle. How did you end up in a niche space like uranium?
Basically, I started my geological career with International Nickel, a nickel company operating out of Australia at that time. And then the oil boom, or the oil shock, happened in 70-71, and all hell broke loose. Where was the next energy fuel? How was electricity going to produce? Because there was a reliance on oil, even in electricity production at that time. So I joined a company called Canadian Superior Oil and worked a little bit there. Started in about 73, and working in Northern Australia. They then that blooded me in the uranium sector, and after that I joined Uranitz, a West German group, or at that time West German, and it was a large, had an international sort of footprint, and very much looking to find uranium and to support what was at that time Germany's nuclear program. Which they did, in actual fact, get to their objectives. I worked there for until 92, and got a tremendous experience, broad, international, spectral, across not only geology but the full gamut, and that's what really got me my sort of uranium credential. When they pulled out of Australia because of political reasons, I then formed a consulting company, and for my golden handshake, I actually swapped their database and got that in lieu of, or part in lieu of. And that became a tremendous asset. I successfully consulted for a few years. In 93, I founded Paladin, and brought in not only a lot of database, a lot of information, all the equipment, and had this consulting company, after which I founded Paladin. We started on a gold, copper gold for 1 year, and then I introduced my board and says, look, you don't know about this uranium, but it's a fabulous commodity to be in. And if it does click, this will be a tremendous opportunity for the company. And that's what happened. Paladin then I got out of, or, you know, it was agreed, there were some dissident shareholders, and in 2015, mainly dissident because of the post-Fukushima effect and certain things. I probably didn't react quickly enough to in terms of managing the debt, thinking that if the Fukushima effect would only be 2 to 4 years. Instead, it's now gone on to 7 years. So that was my uranium experience. I retired then in 2015, August, and really, after 6 months, it dawned on me that there was another happening in the make, and which I wanted to be part of, I looked around for a suitable company, and for many reasons, Deep Yellow, which I am now the MD of, and I took that on, set out its objectives, and I'm glad to say we're achieving many of them 2 years later.
John, I want to talk to you about Deep Yellow in detail as well, but I also want to garner what set Paladin apart from the other uranium companies. And of course, one of the answers is there simply weren't very many uranium companies when you founded Paladin. But Paladin was unquestionably, in its prime, the best performer in the entire space. So is it the stage of development that you were at, or what do you think it was that differentiated you?
Well, I think you need to look at it a bit in a more context. And if I could go back just a little bit, and I'll come back to your question. Uranium mining and the need for it, it's only had a very recent life, probably, seriously started from the 1950s, initiated by a military sort of objective. And then in the sort of 60s, it went into peaceful use, electricity production, etc. But one of the remarkable things about that history, since uranium was mined, probably you could say mid-40s, was that it was a government-inspired initiative that was big, serious stuff. Nobody wanted to mine uranium for electricity at the start because there was no reactors. And that government involvement also involved then huge companies like Rio and very big multi-listed groups. And all of the uranium mining operations subsequently were either government-backed or multi-sort of national diversified majors. In that time then, there was very few publicly listed companies, small juniors, that were participating in this game. And the only one in that in the 50s, at which went on in the 60s, was Denison. So Denison was a small company. It became famous started mining in Elliott Lake in 1957 and continued on as an operator, and then in the sort of 90s became a non-operator. And but that was the only company in conventional mining that put a stamp on the uranium mining from a junior perspective. And the very famous Stephen B. Ramon was the CEO of that. Now, fast forward 50 years later, and Paladin then was the second company that ever did anything like this. So in amongst all those tall timbers, Paladin established a mining footprint. Paladin, more than anything, was not a single expertise company. It had a broad spectrum of knowledge in the uranium space. It became respected by its peers, by the majors. And so what you have to look at that in amongst the 400 companies in the beginning of 2000 or 2006 that came in, essentially it was only Paladin that established modern conventional uranium operations, deploying modern technologies, innovating new processes, and this is the way in which we turned the Langer Heinrich project, which was a Tier 2 project, into Tier 1 status. So that's really what differentiates us. We did something that few companies have done, and that has a bearing actually on what and how you have to analyze the supply growth, and who is it going to do this when so few companies have done that or have the experience to do it. I exclude the ISR, the in-situ recovery operations in the US, and I regard those as small footprint operations. And although ISR is becoming increasingly important with the Kazatomprom sort of development, and it's really the conventional operations that will be the mainstay, or at least co-contribute with the ISR program.
John, before our call, we were discussing the unrivaled enthusiasm that uranium investors have for the sector. And I think much of that can be attributed to how incredible the last bull market was. A lot of factors in place that caused a huge move up, and people who were fortunate enough to be invested in these companies, companies like Paladin, made a fortune on the rise in those equities. Do you see similarities to today, or what similarities do you see to today?
Well, I see incredible similarities, although the dynamic is somewhat different. The aspect of when I came in to uranium with Paladin, it was a pure, absolute contrarian play. Nobody believed that the sector would move. I did with Paladin. There was just a few others, and you couldn't raise equity. Even though there was a bit of an interest in it, share prices didn't react. So getting funding for that idea, to translate that idea into physical assets, was an extremely difficult time. And that's why I'm so thankful to Rick Rule. It's great. You know, everybody has ideas. Everybody knows when properties are, real estate is down. It's a great buy, but at that time banks don't support because the sector's down. So it's a twofold impact on how to get moving in a contrarian environment, not only with the ideas, not only with the belief, but to have that financial backing, which is rare. That's even the hardest thing to do. I always say how many inventors have got some fabulous ideas stored under their workshop bench, not because the idea wasn't good, but they couldn't get the backing and marketing and whatever it was to translate that into something commercial. So today, in this new phase, the real unsustainability of the current production, I've given a few talks about this opaque market that exists, and I regard that as my friend, really. It's not easy to see the market dynamics. You have dozens and dozens of analysts looking at demand side dynamic, which I think we shouldn't worry about. I think demand is there and it will grow, and my issue now is the supply side dynamic. So the big difference when I started Paladin was it was a demand dynamic that drove it, and nobody thought too much about how this new supply was going to come on the market, you know, on the sort of production line. And in fact, staying with that for a moment, if Kazatomprom hadn't gone from 3,000 tons to their 40,000 tons or so, what they grew in within 5 years, while Paladin was growing as well, there would have been a huge hole in supply. And it was nobody believed Kazatomprom would come in with that much growth. But if they hadn't, there'd be nobody around at that time to have sort of filled that gap. So it was almost by a little bit of luck that supply side happened. Yes, it got into overproduction. But in that early period with Paladin, there was no reactors built for years, and so the swallow that showed the spring was, you know, there's a reactor being built, and that's what kicked off that boom. Now it's a little bit different, opaque because, you know, there's the Fukushima effect, opaque because the amount of warehousing of surplus product that where it is, and then predicting when the shortage will happen. All of these things are conspiring to make it a different sort of set of dynamics. But within all this, that uranium has to reach numbers which people think incredible, which in Paladin, all of our supply demand studies were showing that even then you need that $65, $70 a pound to incentivize and maintain that that production capability, even though some claim they can produce at $30 a pound and all of those things. I think it's a much more complicated issue than that.
John, along those same lines, you mentioned that uranium is unique in that its demand just popped up about 60 years ago. And the commodity market as a whole is known as being one of the most cyclical markets, where the biggest driver is not necessarily supply or demand at that time. It's in fact just the up and down nature that causes the constant cyclicality. In that respect, is uranium different than other commodities because it is much newer than, say, gold or copper production?
Yes, and that's a good question. The people, when they think about uranium, they think, oh, you know, yeah, uranium, copper, coal, gold. But all those other commodities have got a pedigree, they've got a history, they have technical teams, they have companies that have managements. Those managements have moved, have developed, built, and have moved to other companies and smaller companies and then become the IP for that to grow. All of these aspects of non-uranium are there so that it becomes a small question how that deposit, marvellous as it is, will be developed and become a producing mine. It's presumed because there are countless competent teams that have done that and will do future ones. With uranium, its short history is one thing. That marvellous period of education going from zero to 440 reactors within a space of 30 years was something where a huge amount of IP was built up. And that IP was both in the back end of the industry and the front end, exploration and all of those things. Universities all had chairs and departments on furthering the understanding of uranium. It was exciting, and so it bred this huge, huge knowledge base. When Chernobyl happened, a whole change started to come in. The people that had been in that business for 20, 30 years moved on to other industries, and some that were in the middle age then, in the 30 years that's transpired before there was another a restart, or 20 years, they all passed away or found other lives. So very few, very small amount of that IP was carried and forward passed by mentoring, by building up new young geologists or whatever. The back end of the industry preserved itself because nuclear reactors had to operate. There was people coming in there, and even though the industry was not most favoured, it still had to have people to support it. So you had this massive exit of people and of groups. So when the Renaissance, as they call it, started in 2003, 2005, whatever year you might want to call it, initiated and catalyst being China. There were just lots of individuals that had experience, that knew the language, a little bit of it, and then they became leaders of the industry and CEOs, and there was a lot of you know, untruths told, the fascination of uranium, and everybody was learning little snippets that they could tell in their conferences, etc. But the spectral understanding of the commodity, the broad nature, the way in which stakeholders are completely different than they are with other mining. Maybe now in coal, there's stakeholders there that put pressure on managers because they have to justify, they have to intellectualize. It's not just dig a hole, crush it and cart it, and after the mine gate, people just close their mind to it, as with most other commodities, by the way. To get the uranium mine going or to be in the uranium business requires you to know and to have working knowledge of all the other concerns that the industry has to face, how you counter them, the confidence which you show, the confidence that you've created in your group, that can individually translate that knowledge to the public forums is a really important part of practicing in uranium. So it was starting to build up a little bit about 2010. I mean, there was lots of companies, those 300 companies I mentioned, and it was only Paladin that produced new production alongside of Kazatomprom. So we in comparison, got to a maximum in 1 year of about 6 to 8% of world production. Kazatomprom, of course, was 30%. That was a government. We were a small company dealing with issues of how to raise funds. We had to do it through debt, and which people criticise me for. But as I say, the Fukushima event was the one that ambushed us. But Fukushima happened, and another exit. So 2011, 6 years, 7 years later, an industry is here from the 435 companies or so that existed in the 2000 to 2008-10 period. There are now 75 companies. And of those 75, there are 45 of those are very small juniors. No deposits, just an idea, no resources, and many of them are moving into other commodities, the battery elements and all of those sort of things. So you've had a hit in the stomach of the IP pool, and that's what should be recognised, that finally there are engineering companies that say, yeah, we can support, but you the corporate group, the executives, the managers there, they have to know, because they've got the steering wheel of the uranium sort of production, and it's through those people that all those responsibilities and efficiencies come through, not by at the end of the telephone calling in some third party, which, as good as they may be, they're not the owners, they just provide the service. So that torturing of the industry has translated into, how I believe analysts should look at the industry and not just presume that because there are 18 deposits available for production, and when you get these groups that analyse this and give these over the sort of production estimates that will happen in the future, they use an illogical base on which to base how and when new production can come in. It'll be filtered, it'll be slower in coming in, there'll be issues, and that will put a natural constraint to growth. It'll exacerbate shortage, and I believe the uranium price will be maintained at high levels because it'll be hard to get into surplus with those constraints.
You brought up a pretty astonishing fact, which is the rate at which Kazatomprom was able to turn on production. And Kazakhstan is under Russian influence. Neither of them are communist per se anymore, but communism might not have been good at many things. It was certainly good at focusing on mass production, whether it be concrete or bad cars or bad shoes, but certainly with uranium in this last cycle. What prevents Kazatomprom from going ahead and turning up production to a level where it would eat into the demand picture again, or oversupply, I should say?
Well, Kazatomprom should be regarded as a phenomenon in terms of what it did. Fooled a lot of skeptics, but it started from a very low base. It had a great resource base there and waiting to be fully exploited. Their deposits ranged in depths from relatively shallow, let's say 150 to 200 metres, then going down to 600 to 800 metres. So the big spurt in production basically came by groups like the Chinese, Koreans, Taiwanese, Japanese, all funding development there through joint ventures, and that enabled Kazatomprom to really fire up. It was always said that probably the sustainable production of Kazatomprom, and a lot of people still debate this, that really it's reached its sort of cruising speed, if you like, and if anything, it's going to back off as they're starting to exploit these deeper deposits, and they become more expensive. The Kazatomprom $10 a pound and $15 a pound, you shouldn't be fooled by that. That's just a leader statement. That's to get you into the door, and then you'll see the more expensive stuff on the shelves in the back. What you've got to look at is that's just processing costs, and then the well field, which is the equivalent of mining, mining operation or a conventional operation, it is not factored into these costs. And so you will have those sort of costs ranging from $10 to $22 a pound. So you add that, and then all of a sudden you've got all up costs of $35 or whatever. But it's even going to get more expensive. So I think there's a natural constraint there. The easy thing, and we're not taking anything away from the Kazatomprom people, but there will. I definitely think there is not going to be another contribution of that size. In fact, I believe it will be very hard to, you know, maybe increase it even 10, 20% on a sustainable basis. We're talking now producing out to 2050. Where people are projecting nuclear reactors and what's going to happen. And you've got to look at it in that sort of time frame. Where is this sort of continual supply going to come from?
Kazatomprom certainly then dampened a price run in terms of incentive price. And that says a lot, because uranium shot up from $7 a pound to about $140 a pound. Looking to today, if we do have this crunch in demand, that would make one think that we could have a kind of rivaled run, or maybe something even greater than that.
Well, I believe the run in uranium in the next phase will be much more, will have greater depth. The Kazatomprom now is starting to realize some commercial realities. You know, the reason why it's liquidated some of its stock is, why is that? Because they're cash strapped. They realize that they're crapping in their own pant, producing a lot, and they're really diminishing the contribution of uranium that could be to their country. So apart from the technical difficulties of increasing uranium, there is now a more pragmatic commercial aspect. I think this listing of the company and what it would do, why one does that, and you know, how it will be exposed to doing things not by numbers but by commercial reality, will make Kazatomprom a player in long-term sustainability and profitability of that product. When you add that to sort of the rest of the world, and you know where these productions are going to come from, it's not just a matter of pulling deposits out of the bag and saying, as some of these people that utilities may think are authorities in outlining future supply, what they are more focused on is demand dynamic and thinking that the supply dynamic is like that Kevin Costner movie. That if you build the baseball field in a cornfield, all the famous people will come to it. Well, it's not quite like that. That the supply will not naturally or easily follow demand because of the many filters in getting geopolitical, technical, as deposits become lower grade, a whole host of issues of regulatory issues, metallurgical, etc. And so I believe the next phase, my long way about this, is that I think it will be long and strong. And the moment the utilities are complacent, and really they are the market makers, the little bit of piddly buying around by Cameco and all of those, yeah, it's incrementally going up the price. But the real show will be the realization that maybe this shortage is structural. And then on that basis, you can say no matter what amount of money you pour into development, it won't come up to where it needs to go, particularly in that post-2023 period, where I think the shortages are looming, things that people will consider and utilities need to understand.
When Cameco shut down McArthur River and Kazatomprom cut back production, the perception, I believe, from the market was that they were doing that because they wanted to allow the price of uranium to rise by cutting back on supply and hence long-term benefit. But is it possibly the case? Because I've heard rumors that Cameco is hitting a difficult part in their mine and maybe Kazatomprom was just struggling with cash, like you said. Is it possible that the case was even worse and they both were forced to make those moves because of how bad the market was?
Oh, I think there was a huge amount of underlying, and the hurt was, if you're flying your aircraft at 5,000 meters and there is a mountain there at 10,000 meters, and even though it's an hour away, you're going to eventually hit it. You must take evasive action. So with Cameco, their long-term contracts, they could see them falling away. And if they had to operate at the spot price, they would be making possibly a loss or a very small profit. So the whole aspect was for Cameco, I believe, was to repair their book, their long-term book, and to get pricing to make people aware. And they also believe that there's this shortage and this oversupply is just a pool of supply that is not going to last forever. There seems to be no looking over the hill and saying, well, okay, here's a supply shortage and how is that going to be overcome? So it was real, and the sustainability issue is real because I believe anyway that an operation is viable and it has to be viable at its spot price and your production costs at a time. These sort of artificial elements of long-term contracts and having those to protect you are only a time-based protection. And there are a lot of people philosophically argue, and the Americans are like that with gold and hedging, that by this sort of hedging, if you like, you also cap your profit and you are denying your shareholder on the one side the reward of investing when things go really positively pear-shaped, but on the other side of the book, these people are protecting the company by having a floor on price. And so the culture of a company, does it sort of open up and give that upside, which is really the tantalizing huge benefit the company can give, and how does it manage these ups and downs? And that's by a combination of a mix of so many percent of your product is in long term and so much in your spot and so on and so forth. Kazatomprom, for instance, doesn't work in the long term market. They do put term contracts out, but they are contracts at the spot price of the time. These various strategies then apply in terms of how companies make their decisions to survive, I guess. And Cameco, I think, were transparently good. They said cutbacks. That cutback reflected in some knowledge that there were, cutbacks in management, in personnel, and you say, oh, hell, that's a real... If you've optimized your whole operations, any production cutback has to reflect in the amount of people you have. Whereas Kazatomprom, on the other hand, is a bit less transparent. It says it does these things, but it has never any mention of the consequential aspects that come into play, like the huge amount of people that they'd have to lay off. And so it's a bit more difficult to understand how Kazatomprom's managed that, although on the year-by-year date, they do look like they have cut back on production.
John, I put a tremendous amount of credence in your read of these costs, items, and pricing. You've mentioned that Paladin ultimately had a debt covenant come up and it fell from grace, but I look at that more as a learning experience, and that leads me to be very interested in what it is you're working on now. I know we're running a bit late on time, but if you have some further time to discuss, can you tell us about your plan with Deep Yellow?
Yes, my thing with Deep Yellow was to embody all of those things that we've spoken about for the last for the last 40 minutes, and it is that a lot of the companies that are around are concentrating on their pre-Fukushima assets and trying to optimize them for a production sometime out in the future. The only ones that haven't done that, that have introduced new excitement in the industry, have been the next gens and the fissions, where new deposits have been created. But nevertheless, they're single company, single project positions. My strategy was that I wanted to focus a dual strategy, focusing on Namibia, which I think is one of the greatest countries for uranium operations, mainly because it's got a jurisdiction that allows production to come in quicker than other countries, while still maintaining all the standards necessary for uranium mining. And in that sense, it has developed three uranium operations, modern ones, or starting off with Rössing in 74, then Paladin's Langer Heinrich in 2007, and then the Chinese Husab operation in 2015. So this is a country that understands modern mining. And my belief that we could increase the resources that the previous managements had defined to a large extent, I thought it was underexplored. And our work in the last 2 years has proven this emphatically. We have found these fertile paleo channels, which are like the Langer Heinrich deposit, and we will achieve our targets on that. In parallel with this, I wanted to consolidate the industry and create, as I've put out on papers, a multi-project global uranium platform, which is what I did with Paladin. That was a huge attraction because it had a downstream production capability. I think that IP is lost now in Paladin, and they're just now concentrating on their mothballed mines. And the world is hungry for this type of for this type of player, and that's the other part of the strategy, and that's takes a while to formulate and get the ideas of how to move that, but that's the dual strategy, and I think it's and that differentiates Deep Yellow, I think, from most other small market cap juniors.
Excellent. Well, John, I thank you for coming on, and thank you for going well over time here into 40 minutes for the interview. I'll definitely reach back out to you. I'll probably have a slew of questions from the audience, and we'll get you back on the show in the future to address those, as well as how the market is shaping up for uranium.
Thank you very much, Colin. I enjoyed talking to you.
Think you understand the junior mining sector, and you think that the participants in the mining sector, junior mining sector, are good people and kind people, hit the bid.
How violent that term could be, it actually could be quite violent. It could be a rip your face off uranium rally.
And the world is always going to need raw materials. It's going to need copper and gold and nickel and so forth.
Totally destabilized. Hey, troll, did you hear what's going on?